The following live presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
This week is the portion of Pekudei. We are actually going to finish the book of Exodus this Shabbat, this Saturday. And so what we've been doing is every week taking a few moments just to share a thought from the portion of the week. I'd be very interested in hearing feedback, and if you're interested in sharing that feedback, you can feel free to email us at Israelite at Israelite.org. That's I-S-R-A-L-I-G-H-T. Okay. So here's an interesting question, right? This is the week, in addition to completing the book of Exodus, that we actually complete the building of the tabernacle, the building of the Mishkan. And in addition to, you know, completing the entire story, there is also the sense that there is the finishing of this mitzvah, this commandment, right? And it's an interesting question, because when you look at the process that we went through over the last five portions, right? First, Truma and Tetzaveh, where we were given the mitzvah, the opportunity to build a sanctuary, to create a space where it would be easier for us, more tangible for us to connect to God. The portion of Kitisa, which has both a continuation of the story of the building of the tabernacle, but more significantly, the sin of the golden calf. And then, of course, the next two portions that we spoke about recently, Vayakel and this week's portion, Pekudei. So this whole process is basically completed this week. And you have a sense that that this was something the Jewish people had to do. Whether it's because in an ideal world we need to create a space for God in our lives, or whether it's because, as Rashi suggests, this was the necessary consequence of the mistake that we made with the golden calf, in that because we were trying to bring God into the world through some tangible vehicle that turned into idolatry, so we need to create that energy and that process in a way that makes more sense with God as opposed to despite God. Either way, this is a mitzvah. And, you know, you do a mitzvah, you don't expect that anybody's going to come over and say thank you for doing the mitzvah. That's not why you do a mitzvah. You know, you're walking down the street, and there's an old lady, and she's crossing the street, and she's blind. So you run over, and you help her across the street. So she says thank you because that's a perfunctory thing to say. That's like saying how are you when you pass somebody in the street when you don't really mean it. But you don't feel that you did it in order to get the thank you. In fact, the thank you is almost unnecessary. Because how could you walk by a person who's blind and 80 years old who needs to cross the street and not help them? It would be amazing if you didn't stop to help them. It would be an indicator that there's something wrong. So if that's true for the normal format of the mitzvot, of the things that we do in this world, so imagine if it's not seeing a woman in distress, and it's not even a woman in distress asking you to help her across the street, but somehow God's self comes to you and says, this is what I want you to do. And so of course you do it. Right? I mean, that's just a given. Which is what makes this particular verse so incredible. Because at the end of this week's portion, Pekudei, it says, this is, if you want to look it up, in chapter 39, verse 32, Perek Lamed Tet, Pasuk Lamed Bet, and all the work of the Mishkan, the Tent of Meeting, was completed, right? And the children of Israel did everything that Hashem commanded them, right? So they did, Kenasu. That's what they did. They were given a mitzvah. They completed the entire process of building the Mishkan, right? And that's it. And you know, now we know that we're done. But what follows, right? Vatechel kol avodat haMishkan, vayasu bnei Yisrael kechol asher tzivaot Hashem et Moshe kenasu. And they did everything that Moshe commanded them, so they did. Why does the Torah have to tell me that the Jewish people did everything that Hashem commanded them? Of course they did everything that Hashem commanded them. I mean, if God commanded you to do something, wouldn't you do it? And note, by the way, that the verse here repeats itself, right? It says, "Vatechal kol avodat mishkan ol moed," and the work of the Mishkan was completed, right? It was included. Everything was done. Vayasu b'nei Yisrael. And b'nei Yisrael did kechol asher tziv Hashem et Moshe. Everything that God commanded Moshe. Kenasu, so they did. There seems to be this emphasis on the fact that the Jewish people complete the job that they were set to do. Right? And that's not enough. Keep going, and you'll see that Moshe isn't finished yet. Because in verse 42, again it says, Kechol asher tziva Hashem et Moshe, according to everything Hashem commanded Moshe, kein asu b'nei Yisrael et kol avodah. So b'nei Yisrael did all the labor. So again the Torah stresses that the Jewish people did it all, which seems redundant. Why is this so important? But even more incredible is that the Torah now goes a stage further. Because the next verse, verse 43, Vayar Moshe et kol ha-malacha, and Moshe saw all of this labor, everything that the Jewish people did that was done. V'hineh asu ota kasher tziva Hashem, and they did it as Hashem commanded them, kein asu, so they did it. Vayavarech ota Moshe, and Moshe blesses them. Moshe says, thank you. So I don't understand. The first verse says, and the Jewish people did everything that God did, said that they should do, so they did it. Then a second verse comes along and says, and all the work that Moshe, that God commanded, the Jewish people actually did it, so they did it. And then it says, and Moshe saw everything that they were supposed to do, and they did everything they were supposed to do, so they did it, and he blesses them. In other words, Moshe is so impressed that the Jewish people have done everything they were supposed to do. The Torah is so impressed that the Jewish people have done everything they were supposed to do, that it actually three times tells me that they've done it all. Why does Moshe bless them? What's the nature of this blessing? Is Moshe thanking them? Since when does Moshe have to say thank you to the Jewish people for doing what God told them to do? There are certain things in this world that you're just meant to do. You know, I remember when I was in the army. So at some point in basic training, right, my parents came to visit. Now, they were living in America, and I was doing the army in Israel. And they were having a visit. And I was desperate to get out for Shabbat to see them, right? I'd seen them the weekend before, so technically speaking, I wasn't supposed to get out. But the thought that my parents were in Israel for a short amount of time, and that I wasn't going to be able to get out of the army to see them was just, it was too painful to bear. It's hard to describe, sitting here in a sterile environment, what it means to a soldier in the Israeli army to get out for the weekend, to leave that horrible world of olive and gray, green, gray, drab, and to enter the world of real food and real people, and to just get some air, right? So when you're in basic training, you don't just go over to your commander, right? You have to go through a whole process. You have to write a little letter, you know, LMMM de Chasamal, to the commander by virtue of the sergeant. There's a format and a process, which you never use later once you finish basic training. So no one really ever understood why you do this, but I guess that you're creating a certain distance and a respect for command. And the end of this process is that you have to go and see if, you know, the sergeants are willing to let you go. So, you know, when you're in basic training, I mean, your sergeant is like, I mean, that's God. And the platoon commander, the officer, the second lieutenant, well, you know, he's the commander of your commander. He's like God's mother. You don't just go over to your sergeant and say, sir, excuse me, you know, could I, you're not allowed to talk to him until he addresses you. And there's actually a format for that too. You walk up to the area where the sergeant is sitting. In this case, one of my sergeants was sitting in a chair outside the tent. It was a hot day. I think he was peeling an orange. And you have to stand like, you know, 6 feet away at attention and wait until he deigns to address you. Right? And so I do this, and I'm sweating, and I'm praying that he's going to listen to me and that it's going to be okay. And I know he's got an answer for me, and I have to reshape the request. And finally looks at me and goes, Ken Friedman, yes, you know? And so I tell him, right? And I'm just waiting for the answer. And he says, Tov, Ichlatnu, you know, we decided that you'll be able to get out for Shabbat. You know? You just got a piece of paradise. At which point I made the ultimate mistake. Because when I finished saying, Ken Amfaked, yes, sir, I added one word. And I guess what the word was? Toda. I just said thank you. That's the normal state of events. And I was about to turn around, you know, and all of a sudden I hear this scream. Ma! What? And I know I've done something wrong, but I have no idea what I've done wrong. Remember that I'm a new recruit in the army, an American to boot, and I don't get this whole culture. At which point, with flashing eyes, the sergeant looks at me, right, points to the top of the hill, looks at his watch, and says, you have 60 seconds, move, which in that world meant you had to run to the top of the hill and get back for 60 seconds. And he proceeded to do this to me for the next 20 or 30 minutes, again and again. Every time I got back, looked at his watch, he said, Shishim Shniyot Zuz. And he kept screaming more and more and more. And finally, at the end of a half an hour, exhausted, breathing hard, not sure what I'd done wrong, he looks at me and he says, Batzava lo omrim toda. In the army, we don't say thank you. Mishuchar, you're released. And I had the entire weekend to think about that. In the army, you don't say thank you. You don't thank somebody for doing what he's meant to do. There's an order. There's a system. And if you're a commander and you're given a mission, you do the mission because you're supposed to do it. Your commander doesn't thank you for fulfilling your mission. And if you give soldiers orders, they do what they're supposed to do. And the whole culture of the army is that you do something because it's what you're meant to do. And you're not looking for anybody to say thank you. The thanks that you get is the knowledge and the realization that you're living up to who you're meant to be. Now, that raises a whole interesting question about the nature of saying thank you, but thank you is not for the person you're thanking. Thanking is for you. In fact, you can make a case for saying that the whole essence of a blessing, right, is that I bless you, right, or I bless a piece of bread. The bread doesn't need my blessing. God doesn't need my blessing. The idea of making a blessing is what it does for me, that it makes me a better person, and it makes me more appreciative, and it brings God into my life, and everything else that a blessing is about, which brings us back to our question. So then why is Moshe blessing the Jewish people? Moshe is not blessing the Jewish people for Moshe. This is not a process that Moshe does because Moshe is getting something out of it. Because if that was the case, it probably wouldn't be in the Torah because we don't really learn much from that. Moshe's character development at this stage in his career is pretty much there. So what's going on here? What's the nature of this blessing? In fact, why are the Jewish people commanded to build a tabernacle in the first place? I mean, clearly the Mishkan, this tabernacle, was for man's benefit and not for God's. So why are Jews blessed for fulfilling what is essentially a project of their own benefit? In fact, it would seem that if this place, you know, there's an interesting psychological idea that stands behind the building of a tabernacle, right? We need spaces in our lives with which we can associate certain ideas. The idea of sacred space is common to religion, not because it's a tool, but because it's an ideal. It's not accidental that there's a place where we can come together on certain days, whether it's Shabbat or Yom Kippur, and around the fact that we're in a space that we've designated as sort of carrying a different energy, an environment that's designed to help us elevate ourselves to a different space, not to mention the possibility of doing that with each other. That's not an accident. So the tabernacle, the Mishkan, gives us this opportunity. In fact, one of the interesting mistakes that people make, the idea of praying for the rebuilding of a temple is not about a building. It's about the value of having a space where all Jews can come together in search of a higher purpose. And there are certain spaces like that in this world. Why do you build a Holocaust museum? I recently took a group to Yad Vashem. Why do I need a museum to the Holocaust? I don't need a museum. The idea of the Holocaust, what we need to remember, you could sit in your living room in a book. You could go to the places in Poland. You could meet a survivor. There is an idea that if I create an energy in a space, I allow people to connect to that idea. So Moshe shouldn't be blessing us for building the Mishkan. We should be blessing God. So what is the idea of this blessing, this sense of thank you, the importance of completing all of the details of the Mishkan, and the emphasis on it, right? In fact, by the way, it's interesting, if we're already discussing the accolades the Jewish people receive for having built the tabernacle exactly according to the specifications, you also have to ask, who really built the Mishkan? Who built the tabernacle? Did all the Jewish people lend a hand in the building? The idea that 600,000 men between the ages of 20 and 60, right, which is the ages of the army, all got together and lent a hand and participated in this building project, it makes no sense whatsoever. I mean, it's hard enough to get two or three Jews together on a project. Can you imagine trying to organize 600,000? In fact, the verses are very clear about who built the Mishkan. The Chachmei Lev, the artisans under Bezalel and Aliyav built it. You can look in the beginning of chapter 36 of Exodus. So why is the entire nation thanked for getting the job done down to the last detail? In fact, this whole portion of Pekudei is all about detail. Ele Pekudei HaMishkan, which literally means these are the accountings of the tabernacle. These are the details. So now that the Mishkan is completed, the Torah gives us what essentially is a treasurer's report of the collections tally, an accounting of all the income and the outlay and the budget, the list of the items that produce down to the last detail. Why do I need to devote an entire portion to such a detailed list? So many of the commentaries speak of the ethical implications, the need for public servants to be accountable, but is there perhaps a deeper principle? that's hidden in this idea, right? And it's interesting, maybe one more detail. Recall that this week's portion is also the concluding portion of the entire book of Shemot. So as a rule, when you study a portion, the beginning and end of that portion allude to the theme of the entire portion. How the Torah chooses to begin and end a section speaks volumes about the theme, the goals of that section. So the end of this week's portion is rather critical towards understanding the theme and indeed the point of the entire book of Exodus, the entire book of Shemot, which makes the end of this book rather puzzling, because the Torah tells us that a cloud covered the tent of meeting, and the glory of God filled the tent, and once the glory of God filled the tent, Moshe could not enter it, which is in chapter 40, verse 35, Pasuk Lamed Hey. And this cloud, which seems somehow to be representative of the glory of God, was also, the Torah tells me, the indicator for the Jewish people as to whether they should set forth and make camp. Right? The Jewish people, we are told, in making their travel plans, do not depend on the weather, and they do not travel based on provisions. They watch the clouds of glory. Why is this the conclusion to the entire book of Exodus? Why is it apparently so important that Moshe could no longer enter the tent of meeting? So the Netziv says a very interesting thing. The Netziv, Rav Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, was the head of the yeshiva of Volozhin in the mid-19th century. And he points out in his Aimek Davar, you can look this up in Lamed Tet, in chapter 39, verse 42, that the tendency of most people in pursuit of great dreams is to go far beyond the tasks at hand. People tend to get so carried away by the process, they forget what the purpose was in the first place. Indeed, the prelude to this challenge is already found in last week's portion. If you remember in Vayakel, last week, the people were so excited at the prospect of building the Mishkan. They were so moved by the opportunity to maybe atone for their mistake in building a golden calf that they could not donate enough goods for the Mishkan. Every morning, piles of material grew at an astounding rate. If you look in chapter 36, verse 3, Perek Lamed Vav, Pasuk Gimel, until the artisans responsible for the execution of the project, they couldn't keep it up. They couldn't keep up with the influx of material. So they say to Moshe, right, Dayaman Lavi, the Jewish people are bringing too much. There's more material than is necessary. Can you imagine? There are too many donations. Every rabbi's dream. The dinner was so successful, there's too much money. And the people keep bringing more. What do we do? So the most incredible thing is Moshe's response. Because Moshe commanded, and the word was spread through the camp saying, let every man and woman do no more work for the donation to the Kodesh, to the Holy, Vayichalu Am Lavi, and people stopped bringing. Moshe stops them in last week's portion from bringing more, because they were bringing too much. How could you have too much? Can you imagine? Vayikaleha Am Lavi. And Moshe says, Vayavihu Kol B'machane, they pass the word in the camp, let everybody stop bringing. So what's really going on here? Maybe what is the root of this whole dialogue is not what the people are bringing, but how they're bringing it. Maybe the Jewish people got so involved in the process, in the idea that they were giving, that they were donating, that they forgot what it was all about. You know, have you ever been to a bar mitzvah that's more bar than it is mitzvah, where they get so into the party they forget that the point of the whole celebration is a young man coming of age and what it means to be a Jew? And it becomes more about the cake and the video. Sometimes we lose sight of the purpose of what we're doing, and we allow ourselves to get so caught up in the process of accomplishing it that we can never accomplish it. And maybe that was what was troubling Moshe. The people were so caught up in the zeal of giving to God, it lost any connection to actually building the Mishkan. Which brings us back to the idea of this week's portion. Maybe the lesson is the value, the power, and the beauty of the details. You know, it's a crucial piece of life. Take, for example, you know, the excitement of love. A special time that you find someone that's very special. And what do they say? Love is in the air. Seems like you can do anything. Doesn't matter where you are, what you do, as long as you're together. But healthy marriages don't last on walks in the park and candlelit dinners. Because the garbage has to get taken out every morning, and the laundry has to get done, and the kids have to be taken to school. And you know, before people get married, they often talk about their shared dreams and their goals and what sort of home they build, but they really get to talk about who picks up the dirty socks and what happens when the laundry basket is full. Most couples work these details out and they come up with their own system for who does what, and often this is just viewed as a necessary part of a relationship, and that's true, right? And when such relationships last, it's because both parties are willing to share their part in the burden. The tragedy, however, is how much this approach loses along the way. Because while this is all very true, it's also very sadly lacking. Maybe the point of this week's portion is that if the details are just the burden of all the chores and details which must be done, to quote the verse, then we're missing the most beautiful part of the process. The real challenge is to embrace the detail as part of a larger picture. You can clean up the kitchen because someone has to do it, and you can even clean up your kitchen because you've been away for a while and your wife works so hard, and how could you not at least clean up the kitchen? And don't get me wrong, if this is how you clean up the kitchen, then maybe you find yourself wistfully imagining how much more fun it would be to walk with your wife into a beautiful restaurant for a candlelit dinner. You're still cleaning up the kitchen. You're doing a good job. But you can also clean up the kitchen because you know it'll bring a smile to your wife's face. And the thought of her smiling when she walks out into the kitchen in the morning makes every dish you clean another rose in the vase. You can so infuse every detail of cleaning the kitchen with the ideal of what you want your relationship to be about that you actually transform your kitchen cleaning into a candlelit dinner. Now, don't get me wrong, this does not dispense with the need and the value of the occasional candlelit dinner. But you can transform the everyday, not by what you do, but by how you choose to do it. And that may well be the message of Parshat Pekudei. The Jewish people, having come out of Egypt, having spent 200 years focusing on just working because they had to work, have a chance now to be given an opportunity to create how you work and not just what you do. And maybe the blessing that Moshe gives them is not because he saw what they did, but because he saw how much love they put into every piece of what they did. And that then is the end of this book. Because if the beginning of this book is the consequence of our selling Joseph into slavery, when brothers could sit next to a pit where their brother lay languished and sell him into slavery without so much as the blink of an eye while they eat lunch, if they can learn over 200 years to build pyramids without understanding the beauty of the pyramid itself, right? Then maybe, ultimately, the message is that we have the opportunity to create in our everyday life a tabernacle in every brick that we build. And that then is the challenge. And God willing that we should succeed, and this is certainly the message of the portion of Pekudei, that we should succeed in transforming all of the different things that we do, all the little pieces of life, into tabernacles built not in the air, but on the ground.
This presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990, or in Jerusalem at country code 972-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.